All right, this interview isn't for everyone. I'm going to tell you that right up front. If you're the kind of person who loves when I go after information for you like a rabid dog, you're going to love this interview. Now, if you're the kind of person who thinks that at times I'm a little obnoxious, forget it. You're going to hate this interview. You're going to think I'm over the top obnoxious this time. But I'll tell you why I did it. Amit Gupta, the person whose interview you're about to listen to, I think is a spectacular entrepreneur. Here's a guy who started a business that you'd call a lifestyle business. It doesn't need any outside funding. It's got revenues. It's got profits. It's got a real business. And so I wanted to find out how he built it. And I think for Amit, building this business just comes naturally. So I had to really push to figure out step by step, what did he do to get it where it is today? And that's what you're going to hear me do in this interview a lot. Is it a little pushy? Maybe. But is it valuable? Absolutely. Absolutely. I know I've got information here that entrepreneurs can use. The other thing I think that's interesting about Amit is that he created something called Jelly. It's a community of people who meet in person around the country, around the world, and I wanted to find out how he did that. Because, as you know, I've got an ulterior motive here. I want you to build a community for yourself. I want you to have a community of people who are going to help you build your company. And the other thing that I want for you to have is actual revenues, a real business. How about that? And so that's why I love this interview, and that's why I was especially eager to interview Amit. My name is Andrew Warner. I'm the founder of Mixergy.com, where like a rabid dog, I will pursue as much information and as much education as I can for you so you can go out there and build an incredible business and then get on the cover of Forbes, on the cover of Fortune, on the cover of CNBC, not just for vanity, though it is kind of cool, don't you think, to be on those programs and in those magazines, but because I want you to build the kind of business that the rest of the world is dying to learn about because they care about it that much. That's the other reason why I want you to be on those magazines. All right. Did I say that I'm the founder of Mixergy.com where I do these interviews? If I didn't, then here it is. And here's my interview with Amit.
What is Photo Jojo?
Photo Jojo is a site, let me start over. Photo Jojo is basically a brand devoted to making photography more fun. And we do that in two ways. We have an email newsletter where we have really fun photography projects and tips and ideas to get you out shooting more and more creatively. And then we have a store where we sell kind of really fun photography stuff. And more recently, we've started to do a bunch of events called Photo Safaris.
What's a photo safari?
Basically, it's something we started doing last year. We did about five of them in San Francisco and in New York, and we find a cool host. In New York, we had Jake Dobkin, who runs Gothamist, and over here in San Francisco, we had Heather Champ, who's the community manager for Flickr. And we get a group of photographers, we come together, and we kind of take a tour through some interesting part of the city and explore it with our cameras. And then we go back to a bar, and everyone can download their photos to be in a big slideshow and win prizes based on which photos the audience likes best.
Gotcha. Yeah. Okay, and it seems that a big part of your business is based, what am I trying to say, that people find you, or people read Photo Jojo by email, not on the web, and that seems intentional, right? You want them to sign up by email. Why?
Well, when I started doing this a few years ago, and it started just as a hobby, I had already stopped opening my newsreader. It was just completely overwhelming to see all those unread items and think, man, I have to like read 1,100 things before I'm caught up. That's just ridiculous. No man can do that every day. So it seemed like the more interesting place to be wasn't producing more content, producing 10 blog posts a day, but really culling all of that information and finding the one or two really most interesting nuggets every week for photography. So that's why we went the email route, because we didn't want to be yet another blog. We didn't want to be lost in a sea of RSS feeds and nobody ever reads. We wanted to be that thing that you actually look forward to getting in your inbox.
But everybody is culling or curating or sorting through information online and trying to present it in different ways, mostly by blogs, it seems today. Correct me if I'm wrong. I think one of the reasons why you went into email is because if you get someone's permission to email them, you have a tighter relationship with them and a longer lasting relationship than if they happen to find you on your website.
It's definitely true that if we require them to just come back to our website when they remembered, it would be a less strong relationship. I do think that if if RSS wasn't as overwhelming as it is, it could be a replacement for email in that way. I mean, it could be sort of a one-way subscription where if you did check into your RSS every day, you would see those sites just like you'd see them in your email if we send you email newsletters. But for whatever reason, RSS just seems to overwhelm people. And they, I've noticed this with everyone that I know that's used RSS or used a reader, they kind of over time check in less and less often and just kind of give up, unless it's part of their job and part of what they have to do to stay alive. So yeah, I think we do have a tighter connection. I don't think it's the, I don't think it's just because it's email. I think it's something about the medium of email versus RSS, but I think that in general, yeah, you're right. If it's something where you're subscribing to it, you're going to have a stronger connection than something that you're not subscribing to.
So did that come into play for you? Did you, you work, well, what I'm trying to say is you worked with Seth Godin, the author of Permission Marketing, right?
Yeah.
Right. And one of his first ideas was to get people to give you permission to market to them or to connect with them over time, right? Did
right,
that
right.
influence you?
Yeah, certainly. I mean, I've read everything he's written, and I certainly learned a lot from him when I was working for him building Change This. We had the email list as one of our primary marketing tools. We also did RSS, obviously, but just watching the power of that subscription list and getting people to come back and pay attention definitely had an impact.
Okay, and how many people do you have in your mailing list?
Our newsletter goes out to 250,000.
Okay, a quarter of a million people, very targeted list, right? How do you get that many people to join your mailing?
I think you don't get them. I think you hope that they come to you, and that's how we've done it. We haven't done any outbound advertising. We don't really do a lot of promotion. We just, you know, we try to put out quality material that hopefully people find interesting.
No one, let me stop you right there. Anyone who's watching this would never allow me to get away with letting you say hope as a business model. And I know that you didn't build your business on hope. How did you get your initial users, and then how did you build it up to a quarter million people?
I think our initial user base came from some of the blogs early on that linked us were really influential. I think the first blog that broke us was 37 Signals, Signal versus Noise, their company blog. And they actually broke the news about us before we had launched, so we had to launch a couple weeks before we had planned to. And that certainly didn't hurt. But really, beyond that, it was just word of mouth, and that's really what we've depended on, and making it easy for people to delicious stuff or otherwise share stuff online, and more recently making it easier for people to Twitter about stuff that we're doing. So certainly we give them the tools to share what we're doing with others, and if we think that there's something we've written that would be particularly interesting to a certain blog, we'll write to them and let them know about it. But really it's just been people telling their friends.
Okay, I'm gonna dig a lot deeper here because I want to learn more. And I'm gonna start with getting bloggers to link to you. Why would 37 Signals break, as you say, break a story about somebody creating an email newsletter about photography? It doesn't seem like a break-worthy story. You're not reinventing anything online, right?
Yeah.
What was it about your story that made it compelling for them?
I think there's always got to be something, as Seth calls it, that's remarkable or interesting, or something about what you're doing that's unique and kind of catches people's eyes. And for us, with that launch, I think it was just the design of the site. They really liked the copy and the design that we had. And it wasn't that we were doing photo DIY stuff, because there's probably a lot of sites that do photo stuff and a lot of sites that do DIY stuff. But 37 Signals in particular has a very strong focus on creating very sharp marketing copy and very clean, simple sites. And they're actually one of the, you know, the people that I looked to when I was designing our site. So I assumed that somehow somebody, one of my friends, told them about it, and they saw the site, and it looked like their kind of site, so they linked to it.
So it just looked so simple that it was remarkable for them, right?
I think so. I mean, it's kind of interesting. I feel like there's a lot of the time the stuff that ends up helping you succeed isn't the stuff that you expect to help you succeed. It's not necessarily like, working the phones 24 hours a day, or like cold calling tons of people, or like going to every networking event. It might just be the small things that you're doing that show that you care and really show that you're paying attention, whether it's the design or the copy or the voice of the writing or just the way you treat customers or whatever.
One of the things to this day that I think is remarkable about your website is how simple the front page is. It's basically a registration page, right? I don't see lots of articles. I don't see lots of entries. I don't see requests from my friends. It's just what? Can you describe it?
It's just basically a few sentences that says what we are and why we're doing it, and then a box to tell people that they can subscribe.
And that's...
And they can dig in. They can look at... If they decide to click on the archives tab or the store or whatever, they can learn more about us. But the homepage is just, here's what we do, and subscribe and you'll find out more.
Okay, and it looks beautiful. And did you design it, by the way?
Yeah.
You designed it. Looks incredibly beautiful. Everything that you do has a sharp look to it. If anyone is watching this and hasn't seen Photo Jojo, I hope they click the link and go over to your website to check it out.
Thanks.
And that I could understand why 37 Signals would write about that. What about other bloggers? Why did they write about your site?
Well, at the time, I think when I was starting it, I saw a lot of my friends taking lots and lots of photos, right? You get a digital camera and you just start snapping away. There's no cost in taking another 100 photos. And before you know it, you've got 10,000 photos sitting in iPhoto or Picasa or whatever you're using, and you never see the stuff that you take. You take it, maybe you post it to Flickr, and then it's sort of just forgotten. And I also saw a lot of people starting to customize the stuff in their lives, kind of taking a more DIY approach to the objects in their lives. So our approach is really to take those two trends and see if we could produce some interesting content at the intersection of DIY and photography. And I think part of the reason why we got blogged so much early on, especially, was that wasn't something anyone else was doing. There were a lot of blogs that were talking about the newest cameras, and there were a lot of blogs that were doing lens reviews, and there were lots of blogs that were just giving you like Photoshop tips over and over and over again. And those blogs still exist and they do great. But that wasn't us. We were trying to find ways to help you be more creative and have more fun. And that was unique. And I think it still is.
Okay. So even in a market that's so saturated, lots of people talking about photography, lots of people posting photographs, lots of people writing content in general, you're saying you found a niche, which was photography, you say DIY, do it yourself, right?
Andrew, you make it sound so simple. Yeah, that's exactly what we did.
I'm going to push in so hard because I feel that that it seems oversimple when I hear you describe it, but I'm sure a lot of it is because it just comes natural to you. But that's my job. What you do comes naturally to you, and it must seem easy. 250,000 people, word of mouth, Andrew. We have a couple of delicious links, a couple of people on Twitter about us, and that's how we end up with this big business. My job, I feel, is to dig in and try to dissect it and figure out what some of the magic is, so anyone who's watching this can take some of your magic and apply it to their business.
Sure.
Okay, so part of it is site looked good, 37 Signals talked about it. Let's dig into that part. Did 37 Signals know you directly?
No, I think my friend Janelle knew Jason or knew somebody at 37 Signals. I've actually never asked her about this, but I think that she had put it up on her Vox blog or on her, you know, just her personal blog, and maybe Jason had seen it there.
Okay. All right. I was kidding about it earlier, but I think it's worth going in a little deeper. The delicious link, the share, you said earlier that you make it easier for people to share your stuff, make it easier for them to Twitter. How do you mean? I don't think I noticed that. You mean when I get one of your emails, you've got links inside that says delicious this, add this to Twitter, add this to any of the other networks?
Yeah, and I think we're actually kind of outdated in this respect, and the email requires a redesign that hopefully will come in the next month or two. But we started out with just a delicious button in the email that basically obviously just takes you to delicious and pre-fills in the information for that post. If we were starting over today, we'd probably do Facebook and Twitter, so that's probably what we'll be moving to. Although right now when we do store emails, we include a Twitter link with each product link that will let you just sort of post to Twitter about that product.
Within a store, there's a button that says send this to Twitter, tell people.
Within the emails that we send about store products, yeah, and that's actually really like surprisingly popular. People will just click that and talk about the products and promote them for us. And we also have another email we send out called the Time Capsule, which looks at your Flickr stream, and every couple weeks It basically looks at the photos you took a whole year ago and finds the most interesting photos and sends them to you in an email. So we also have a Twitter link in that that just lets people share their that week's time capsule with their friends, and that's really popular as well.
I see. Okay, but that wasn't around. Mm-hmm. I guess Delicious was a little while ago, but Twitter obviously wasn't, and the other services still aren't on your website. So that's not what helped you get your first 100,000 people.
Honestly, it was word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
I wish there was a secret, I wish there was some kind of secret tool that we used or some, shady place we could go and just, give $100 and get 100 users or something like that. But it took 3 years to get here, and if we had been able to do it faster by spending money, we would have done it faster by spending money. But I think we would have gotten people who weren't as engaged and not quite as targeted. So it just took time and putting out reliable content on a steady schedule and keeping at it.
What about, actually, reliable is important. I get your emails on a weekly basis, right?
Mm-hmm.
How tough is it for you to put out your email every single week for 3 years now?
Twice a week.
Twice a week?
Yeah. It's sometimes quite difficult. I think that when we started, we had thought we'd go up to being a daily eventually, or at least three times a week. And we realized that if we did that, we just would be writing about stuff that we didn't think was totally awesome. And so we had to cut that back. And even now, sometimes some weeks there's lots of stuff that's going on that's really exciting we want to talk about. And other weeks there's nothing, and we have to create something of our own to talk about. So it's hard, and I think there are times when I thought maybe we should go back to a schedule where we just put stuff out when we find something really amazing. But I think that there's something important about sending it out when people expect it, and just being there every week consistently. I think that certainly from an email perspective, it's good, because if you're emailing people and you don't send them email at the same interval that they expect, they tend to forget that they ever subscribed in the first place. Like if you go 2 months without sending them anything, they'll get an email and they'll say, what the hell is this? I never subscribed to this, and they'll mark it as spam. So reliability definitely helps on that. But just in general, people look forward to it. And I think if we don't come up with something great and we don't do it, every Monday and every Thursday, then we're letting them down.
Seems like the kind of business that you could live and travel the world with, right? You're taking pictures everywhere. I actually been watching your pictures. I see you in different spots around the world. Mm-hmm. Are you traveling while you're running Photo Jojo?
I do tend to travel. It's mostly for work. I might go to photo conferences, or if we're doing events in New York, I might be in New York for that. My family's in the Northeast, so I was back for the holidays for that kind of thing. But yeah, in general, it's a pretty mobile business. We have an office here in San Francisco where three of us work together. We're hiring, by the way, photojojo.com/jobs. And so it's definitely something where, there are certain projects where it just helps to be in person, especially when we're building something new. But for the day-to-day stuff, it's not essential, and that's nice.
Like what? When you're building, what would you need to be in the office for?
Like when we were redesigning the store towards the end of last year, we were rebuilding kind of the store platform from scratch and redesigning it. And this year we're looking at a number of kind of new web app projects for photography. And when we get into the meat of that, it just helps to be able to point at things and draw things on the whiteboard and just be in person to do that kind of thing.
Is that where the bulk of your revenue is coming from the store?
It's about 50-50. We're focused a bit more on the store because, I guess just personal taste. I don't really enjoy selling advertising. It's something that I think some people have a knack for, and we've been successful doing because people have come to us and we just sell to the people that knock on our door. But if you were a real salesman, you would puke at hearing that, and you'd say that I'm the world's worst ad salesman, which I admittedly probably am. So yeah, we're focusing more on the store, and hopefully that'll eclipse the advertising sales, and over time that'll become less a part of our business.
Just because you personally prefer to sell directly to people?
Yeah, it's so refreshing. I've done a lot of stuff on the internet before, and there's just something so refreshing about handing people like atoms, and they give you they give you money, and you know, it's not just that you're trading like ephemeral bits traveling over a wire for money. You're actually giving them like an object that has real value, because people know that objects have value. So it's kind of nice. I like that.
Jason, actually, from 37 Signals, when I interviewed him, said you've got to sell directly to your audience. The idea that it's all about advertising, somehow paying your bills, it's just it's easy to say advertising will pay the bills, but really you should be looking.
I think it's hard to say advertising will pay the bills. That's so much more difficult.
Well, most people don't see it, though. Most people see advertising as just Google Ads. I'll build a great business. I'll run some Google Ads. When I make enough money from that, I might hire a salesman who will save the day and sell directly to advertisers for me. Right. But they're missing out on what you're saying is so exciting to you, which is selling. What, beyond the fact that you don't like selling ads, what's great about selling directly to your audience?
Well, I think it's, you're definitely getting into a tighter relationship with everyone you sell to. It's one thing to have someone visit your site. It's another thing to have someone subscribe and say, yeah, I want to hear from you every couple of weeks. And then it's, you know, a yet another step to have somebody say, here's my credit card, and I trust you to, like, actually do what you're going to do, and I'm going to pay you money to do it. And I think that's really powerful. And having those people give you that trust is, it's yet another audience that we're building. It's the audience of people that's willing to pay money for what we're doing and support us in that way. So, that's certainly exciting too.
Was it hard at first to decide that you're going to ask your customers, your readers, to pay?
To when we started selling stuff? No, I think it felt natural. I think that we kept coming across stuff that we weren't seeing being sold anywhere else, and just seemed kind of crazy. And it felt like a natural service to be able to not only, give people ideas and come up with projects and occasionally review gear, but also actually sell the stuff that we thought was the most awesome stuff that we were finding. I do remember initially I've been playing with the ideas of making it a closed list. So we would only let 1,000 people subscribe, and then like every so often we'd open the gates and let another 100 people in, that kind of thing. And I also thought about making it a paid list. I still have other ideas for email lists, and some of them do involve a subscription where you pay, a few bucks a month or 10 or 20 bucks a year to subscribe to this email list. So charging people for something was definitely something that I'd been thinking about from the start. And I think that it's a different, people think about you differently when you charge them, especially if you charge them for content. I think they just treat it as a lot more valuable because they're giving money for it, even if it's the same content, ironically.
Are there any services that you pay for online?
It's funny, I probably don't pay for that many. And I think it's kind of weird that like you'll balk at paying 25. I've paid for Flickr for a few years, but people will balk at paying for Flickr, where it's like a dinner out, or some sites cost $10 or something, and that's what you'd pay for a couple beers. Yet it seems absurd to pay for a year's worth of website usage. Let me see. I know that I just subscribed to Pandora, which I really love, and I wish that they would. I really wish they would give me more for subscribing. It took me a long time to actually pull the trigger on that, because it felt like I was getting nothing for subscribing, and that's kind of lame. I pay for Basecamp, and I'm trying to think what else I pay for. I think I'm paying for a Toughmail email account. I don't know. I'd have to check my receipts to see what I'm paying for. I'm paying for Skype. I'm probably paying for a couple other things.
What's Toughmail?
Toughmail, it's just an email provider. It just provides IMAP accounts.
I see. Yeah. Similar to Gmail.
Yeah, but not as good.
So you're paying for a service that's not as good as the free service that Google gives you, Gmail.
Yeah, it's just sometimes you just get into these things and you start, and then something better comes along and the switching cost is too high and you just never make the time to do it.
Yeah, I find the same thing that happens to me, or even worse, I sign up for a monthly subscription and then I just leave it on my credit card and I keep meaning to cancel, but don't get around to it. It's invisible.
I would probably pay for Mint. I think Mint is one of my favorite sites right now. And It's actually gotten to be more and more useful because every bank and every credit card makes it harder and harder to log in, it seems, every week. And I'd never log in anymore. I just use Mint, and that's so great.
Yeah.
And I'd pay for QuickBooks if QuickBooks Online worked on the Mac and actually wasn't horrible.
So I think that it's easier to sell atoms, as you say, to sell people on, you sell them SD cards for their cameras, you sell them cameras, I think, also, right? You sell them photo albums, if I remember.
Mm-hmm.
And it's easier to sell that. It's easier to sell tools for business. It's a lot harder to sell content, right?
So far.
So far. Okay.
I think, people will buy content in some forms. They'll buy books still, kind of. We're doing a book. It comes out in September, so I hope by that point people will still be buying books. But I think eventually that's also probably a dying trend.
All right. Talk to me more about the traveling that you've gotten to do while you worked here. I did an interview with our mutual friend, Kareem Mayan, who's traveling the world. People loved hearing how he was traveling, how he wasn't locked into a desk. Can you tell me about some of your travels?
Sure. I've done nothing as exciting as Kareem has.
None of us have.
I went to my cousin's wedding in Delhi, and I spent 3 weeks in Delhi, and I was working while I was there. And, the time difference was obviously a challenge, but everything else was kind of pretty easy. Internet was reliable. I was in Cologne for a photo conference for about a week, and I was working while I was there. And then the bulk of the rest of my travel is usually between New York and San Francisco. I used to live in New York. I spent about 4 years there before moving here a year ago. And I just still have a lot of contacts, a lot of connections and friends out there. So I end up traveling there every month or every couple months.
Okay. And what about, what else do I have here on this list? Okay. Anyone who's thinking of switching to email instead of blogging or instead of building out a website, what do you say to them?
Well, know your audience. Like, make sure that your audience is actually reading mail. And if they are, find out where they're reading it. They might be reading on a BlackBerry or on an iPhone, not an actual email client. And if I were starting now, I might look at how I could build something on top of a platform like Tumblr or Twitter in addition or instead of. It's not entirely clear where those platforms are going to go and if it's going to be possible to really monetize content you're creating on those platforms, but there's definitely some advantages in terms of building a base more easily if you build on top of those services.
So if you were starting today, you might try building Photo Jojo on top of Twitter instead of on email?
I think I'd definitely use it. I'm not sure exactly how I'd use it. Like, we've thought about building, one of our most popular projects is Project 365, where we try to get people to take a photo every day for a year, because you get better the more you do something, especially is true with photography. The more you take photos, the better photos you take. And the thing that people run into is they start this at the beginning of the year, they're very excited, and then it sort of peters out around now, actually, around middle to end of January, because you're just out of ideas. And I think one of the services we've been thinking about building is giving people a daily idea for something to take a photo of. So we thought about using Twitter for that and using Twitter as basically a text messaging platform.
Are you getting another message in, by the way?
Yeah, hold on a second.
Go for it.
Sorry about that. Oops.
All right, let's talk about Jelly. What's Jelly?
So Jelly is an event where like-minded people come together and work together on their own projects for a day. And it started around the same time as Photo Jojo, so about 3 years ago, in my apartment in Manhattan. And I was working on Photo Jojo. My roommate Luke was working for a startup in California called Joyant. And it was kind of lonely, honestly, working for ourselves or working for a company, but working, remotely. So we started to invite friends over to work with us for the day. I think our friend Jacob was actually the first one, and we just sort of occasionally just mentioned to people, hey, we both work from home. If you want to drop by and work with us someday, bring your laptop. And eventually people started to invite their friends, and it became more regular. And Jelly was born.
Why'd you call it Jelly?
I'm going to make up a better story. I swear, every time people ask me, I say the same thing.
No, go with the boring story. I mean, I want the truth, not the
excitement. And I were trying to come up with a good name for it, and there was a bowl of jelly beans on the table, and that's what stuck. I'm sorry, Andrew. There's nothing.
But that's great.
That's all I got.
All right. So you're now at your place with your friends, each working on your own projects. I'm now in California. This happened in New York, right?
Yeah,
I'm starting in California. There. People do it here.
How did
it spread?
I'm going to try to think of an answer that's not just people tell their friends, because that's what actually did happen. But I'll see if I can make up something more compelling for you.
So what was the, let's go back then and say, what was the second group that started, the one that you didn't create yourself?
I think it was probably Philadelphia. I think Alex Hillman in Philadelphia started Jelly, and people probably heard about it in relation to Bar Camp. So I planned the first two Bar Camps in New York. Bar Camp's kind of like a technology unconference. It's not organized by any large company. It's organized by a bunch of volunteers like me. And we, there's no speakers that are set out in ahead of time. There's no keynote addresses. It doesn't cost anything. And the ones we did happened over a weekend with a sleepover in between Saturday and Sunday. And people just show up. There's a big grid. You can write your name and what you want to write about on the grid. And then you just talk about it. And people either show up or they don't. So anyway, that was kind of a very grassroots technology conference that I helped organize. And then Jelly was in a very similar vibe. And it kind of spread in a similar kind of way. People heard about Bar Camp from their friends and thought, wow, that's so cool. I could start my own conference and like talk about stuff that's interesting to me. And in the same way, people started blogging. People who came to our Jellies would blog about it, and other people would hear about it and say, oh, that's so cool. I wish I knew people here in Philly or Chicago or LA or wherever that were doing tech stuff that I could do, that I could work with, because it's lonely working from home and it sucks to work from Starbucks. That's primarily how it's spread. And now it's in dozens of cities and in a bunch of other countries. And we're starting this new stuff, a speaker series with our sponsor, Yahoo. Tomorrow's the first speaker series session.
So I interviewed the guys who created Talk Like a Pirate Day. And they said because they didn't want anyone to give them credit when they started talking like a pirate or added pirates to their websites on Talk Like a Pirate Day, because they didn't want credit, the message spread. Did the same thing happen with you? Because I didn't have to get permission from Amit to create Jelly in my city, I could go ahead and do it. Because I didn't have to get permission from you or interview you to blog about it, it would spread? Can you talk about that, about ownership of an idea versus letting it go?
I definitely think that the lower the barriers are, the faster something will spread. And the more ownership you can give over something, the more likely they are to take it and make it work for their city or for themselves. So, we made Jelly as self-service as we possibly could. It's all run off of a wiki to create a page for your city. You just go on, and the password's on every page. You just type in the password and create your page. We have a tutorial that Dusty, the organizer from Austin, and I wrote up on how to get started and how to promote in your city and that kind of stuff. So if you want to, you can just go through that and kind of take the steps and spread the word and get going. There's a Google group where all of the organizers kind of discuss stuff. And if you want to start a Jelly in Winnipeg, you go online, you introduce yourself, and hopefully people will help answer the questions that the tutorials didn't answer. So yeah, it's in an ideal world, like I don't even need to exist. Jelly keeps going, and I don't need to do anything. And I think that definitely helps it go, because it means that if I'm on vacation, things don't draw to a standstill. Or if I'm stressed out because of something else, I don't hold things back.
And if I just wanted to do it on my own here in California or somewhere in Europe, I could just start it on my own website, say, this is the concept.
Yep.
And go with it. No credit to you, no linking to the wiki, no participating in the conversation.
Yeah, you could. I mean, I think that the reason the wiki exists and the reason the email list and stuff exists is because it's sometimes hard to kind of build momentum and get the first few people interested. So we can help with that because we have kind of name recognition. People have started to hear and know what Jelly is. But certainly nothing stops you from just going and doing it on your own and setting up your own site or even calling it something else and just taking the idea. And I think that's great too. I think that this is something that it seems like we need more of now that we're more of us are working remotely or working from home, and however we can fill that need, great.
Seth Godin said the same thing to me, that he's actually happy when people don't give him credit, when they take the ideas and go with it on their own. Why does that make you happy? Don't you want credit, fame, people to be excited about what you created, people to at least credit you? Even the best artists, they sign the bottom of their work.
Yeah, I mean, I think my name's in the bottom of the Jelly website or whatever, so it's good enough. I don't know. I think part of it is that there really wasn't a profit motive behind Jelly. It was just something that grew out of personal need. And it's not something I'm doing to earn my living, so I don't feel the need to protect it or have this stranglehold over it. And if it's helping people and if people can adapt it and fit it to fit their needs, then great. I mean, I don't need to control it or make people do it the way I want them to do it, or yeah, it doesn't matter.
So what's the benefit to you? If you're not doing it for profit, you're not doing it with an ulterior motive in mind, have there been any benefits?
I've met a lot of really interesting people, both in the jellies that I've gone to and the jellies that and the organizers of the other jellies that have sprung up all over. And it's probably the primary benefit for me, just coming across a lot of like really intelligent, really interesting people.
I see. What about couch surfing? I've heard that you've gotten in different cities, you've been able to find friends to stay with because of Jelly.
Yeah, I guess that's true. It's weird. Once you start a relationship, you tend to over time forget how it began, but it's probably true that a lot of the friendships I've formed in various places have started through one of the projects that I started and a conversation that grew around that. So yeah, that's an added benefit, right?
You're in San Francisco right now?
Yeah.
All right. A lot of your friends have funding from top VCs, right?
Yeah.
Which means that once you get funding, you're aiming to build a $100 million business, right?
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of your friends are aiming to build a $100 million business. Many of your friends have already done it.
Mm-hmm.
Do you feel the same urge to do that, to build a $100 million business?
Sometimes.
You do.
Sometimes, but not usually. I mean, I went through that with the first dot-com boom. I dropped out of college after my sophomore year and started this company called The Daily Jolt. We raised $1.5 million in Angel, and we're, you know, talking to VCs about our second round when we discovered that the bottom had just dropped out of the dot-com, and there was no chance in hell we were going to raise any money. And that company's still alive. Like, somehow we were able to cut back and keep it going. But hold on one sec. Mm-hmm. Yeah, should be fine. This conference room is in use in 20 minutes, FYI.
Okay.
Where was I?
So
you're telling
me Daily Jolt raised money, it's still alive.
And right, certainly sometimes I see people raising a lot of money and going that route and trying to make it big or just going bust. And there's a lot of advantages to something that, especially when your space is crowded. I think it's just something you need to do, because if you're in a space with a lot of competitors and your competitors have more money than you do, it's really tough to come out ahead. And if you're lucky and you have a niche where you don't have a lot of competitors, or you're in an economic climate where the competitors can't raise money either, then you're okay, because your business model is lean and you're growing based on revenues. And it's certainly, you know, it makes it easier to, I think it makes my lifestyle a lot more sane than it was back in 2000 when I was running the Daily Jolt, because back then we had such high expectations and we needed to hit these crazy targets and be able to raise the next round. And then we had to hit even more crazy targets to hit the next round and even more crazy targets to get acquired or to IPO. And now we can actually set sane goals that we can achieve and then grow based on money that is coming in, not money that's being given to us by investors. And I don't know, it's nice. I like it.
And you're profitable now, right?
Yeah.
What are your revenues?
Exactly. Who knows? Who knows, Andrew?
Who knows? Come on. Who knows how we're growing our business? We're hoping we'll get email addresses. Who knows how much revenue is coming in? Can you talk roughly? I don't want to push for anything that you can't say. I know you're a private company, but if you can give us a sense of how much a business like this could make, I think it'll help a lot of us learn.
Let me think. I think we probably did around $200,000 or $250,000 in revenue in the store in the holiday season. I don't have a good idea off the top of my head what we did for the rest of the year, but it was obviously a lot less because it's a cyclical business. And advertising-wise, it's so dramatically kind of all over the map because it just comes in when it comes in. We don't pursue it. It's kind of hard to put a real number on that.
I see. So it's a great what they call lifestyle business, right? I always hated that term lifestyle business because it makes you feel like, well, if you don't have venture capital, then you're probably just enjoying your lifestyle. You're sitting out on the beach somewhere. But that doesn't seem like what your business is, right? You're working hard just about every day. It sounds like 6 days a week.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yeah, I don't hate the term. I think it's a great term. Yeah. I mean, I think it means that like I've got the ability to control how fast we grow and how we do things and what we do, and it's not determined by an investor or some outside advisor or any other person. And that to me is what lifestyle business means. It's having the ability to control your destiny. And that's really why I decided to become an entrepreneur in the first place.
Me too. I've never actually, outside of college, I've never had a job. I love entrepreneurship because you could invent something in the shower in your head, come into work, see it happen, and not have anyone question you. Just make it work, right?
Yep.
Okay. I'd like to also talk to you about Eric Stevens. And we said in the emails before this that we wouldn't spend too much time on this, but
sure.
He's a huge fan of yours. You helped him build his business. Eric Stevens got a website called Beer Menus. Because of you somehow, he got in the New York Times, gave him incredible credibility, got him more traffic, got him more publicity. How did that happen?
I think you're probably overstating my role in his success, but
I think you understate, first of all, how much admiration there is for you. Have you been in Los Angeles where I am in the last year? No. Your presence is still felt here. Eric and I have had conversations about you. Kareem Mayan and I have had conversations about you. Others have talked about how you created Jelly. So you may not realize it, but you're impacting lots of people beyond where you're impacting lots of people.
Well,
so
cool.
I don't want to overstate it, and I don't want to make you feel uncomfortable here. And maybe there's nothing here that we can duplicate, but I'd love to learn how you were able to help Eric.
Well, Eric built a very very niche, perfect site, right? It's a very kind of single purpose site that beer aficionados will love. And he emailed me and I think a couple other people for advice on spreading the word. And I'm not a beer nut. I'm just learning how to drink beer, still learning how to drink coffee and wine. Like, these things are new to my existence and they've only kind of come into in the last year, and I'm still kind of learning how to do this stuff. But he was looking for, places to promote it. So I think I referred him to Ben, a friend of mine who runs Thrillist, which is a email newsletter for guys in New York, kind of similar to Candy, but Daily Candy, but for guys. And I think I just sent him to a couple other blogs and a couple other people who might be interested in specifically what he was doing and writing about it. And then the rest was all him. He told them what it was and was his usual charming, great self, and made the case for why Beer Menus was interesting, and they wrote about it because it was.
And so your part in this was just making the introductions.
Yep.
You're what John Bischke, who I also interviewed, you're what he would call a connector, right?
If you say so.
You were the most – how is it that – let me tell you this. Now, I've been doing about 100 interviews so far. The people who – often don't know anything, don't do anything, are the most aggressive, pursue me more aggressively than anyone else trying to get me to do interviews. I get them on here and they talk my ear off with nonsense and they've done nothing. Meanwhile, you've got a business that other people admire. You've got a community here that you probably don't know completely, but you've influenced them, and I can't get you to tell me how great you are.
Well, so, why should I tell you how great I am? There's lots of people that are, doing more exciting stuff, more interesting stuff. The world is full of unique people who do great things, and I don't even know what I'm doing with my life. I'm just doing things that seem fun and interesting.
How true is that? Are you still trying to figure out what you're trying to do with your life, how you can leave your mark? Yeah?
Absolutely, every day.
Are you humbled by guys like Seth Godin who are leaving messages, who are inspiring people? You are.
How could you not be, yeah.
So how do you get on that path? I am too. I talked to this man. He's living a wonderful life. He's an entrepreneur, building a business, building ideas, and spreading the word about those ideas to people who are passionate for them. How did you go from where we are to where he is?
Are you sure you want to?
I want more. I mean, we all want more, right?
I don't know. I mean, are you not happy?
I'm happy, but I'm happy pursuing more, aren't you?
I don't know. I'm happy just making interesting things, making fun things and building things and I don't really have. And maybe I should, like, maybe this is part of the reason I don't know what I'm doing with my life. Maybe I should have some sort of, like, you know, specific life goal that I'm aiming towards, or a person I'm trying to emulate, or something. But really, I'm just, you know, like everyone else, trying to find what makes me happy. And I know that a big part of that is just making interesting things, whether it's interesting things on the web or events or what have you. So that's what I'm doing until some better alternative comes up.
So your goal is to just say, I feel like starting this group, or I feel like nurturing this group, or I feel like bringing the speaker in and being able to do that.
My goal is to be happy.
Yeah? And are you happy?
I'm getting there. I mean, I am some of the time, and some of the time I'm not, like anyone else.
What would it take to get you there?
I don't know. If I knew, I wouldn't be talking to you. I'd be doing that.
See. All right. So here's what I'm seeing. You're doing interesting things. You've got a business that's profitable, so you're not hurting for money. You're not trying to figure out how to pay the grocery bills, right? Or how to get the next round of funding in the door. Just trying to find out where that greatness is, what you could do with yourself. And because of the lifestyle business that you've built for yourself, you have the freedom to look for it. Yeah?
Yeah.
What's the best part of being an entrepreneur?
Just having power over your life. I think just being able to control what you do and why you do it and when you do it. I think that is just huge. I think it's kind of intimidating. I think that having to decide all the time where you're going to spend your energy and what you're going to do with your time is hard, but it's a luxury that most people don't have, and it's something that I know I take for granted. When I realize what a privilege it is, I'm kind of humbled by the fact that I've been given this opportunity or had this opportunity.
When I push you and tell you about my ambition, do you recognize any part of this in yourself, or do you think that Andrew's a little nuts? At some point in the future, he'll outgrow this, or I don't know, something will
happen. No, I think everyone needs something different to be happy, and some people, you know, have great ambitions. Maybe you have greater ambitions than I do, and I'm sure that you'll achieve them, and I wish you the best of luck, and if there's anything I can do to help you, you know, get to those goals, obviously I will. And I honestly wish I had, like, a specific goal, like, I need to get here, because then when I got there, I'd be done. Like, I could just go to that island and just relax and have my, you know, fuzzy navel or whatever. But I don't, right? As far as I know, I'm going to be on this treadmill for the rest of my life, just building stuff that makes me happy. I'd rather have a goal.
So what's the thing that you've built that you're proudest of?
Oh, it's proudest of. That's a good question. I think I'm pretty proud of PhotoJojo as a whole. I think that's probably the thing that I'm happiest with. I think that I'm especially happy that it's proved itself to be so flexible. It just started as an email, and now it's got this time capsule and a store and events, and we're building kind of this photo education thing later this year. And it's been really cool to see how we've really built something that's just kind of stands for photography and fun, and people do recognize that.
Well, thank you. Thanks for doing this interview with me. I'm a big fan, and I'm glad that I got to meet you this way.
Well, thanks. Yeah, it was fun.
And there's the interview. So what do you think? Did I push too hard? Was I a little too obnoxious? Let me know. The last thing I want to do is be a gotcha journalist. What I want to do is learn, and I want to do it in a respectful way, and I want to pull back information that you can use. So let me know. If I went too far, I'll know for next time. But if I got you the kind of information that you need to build a company, let me know that too. And more importantly, go out there and use what you've just learned here. Go do something with it. Next, check out Photo Jojo. Jojo is J-O-J-O. PhotoJojo.com. See what he built over there. I think sometimes when you just see the website for yourself, you get a better sense of what works there and why it's so successful. Finally, come back to Mixergy.com, download a bunch of other interviews, find things and information and interviews that you can use to build up your successful startup. Help me get more traffic over to my website too. All right, that's it for announcements. Get in touch with me. Go check out both our websites. I think I said it all. See you soon.